headlines, Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says Lieutenant General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. 2 years ago, is the symbol of hope and perseverance in the region. A leading food industry body warns about food shortages in the U.K. as new post-Brexit custom rules take effect. And many countries around the globe welcome the new year with celebrations overshadowed by the coronavirus pandemic for the second year. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are top stories this hour. Now, Iran's Islamic Revolution leader says Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in 2020, has turned into a role model for the younger generation. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the martyrdom of the top general as a national and international event. The leader said the nationwide commemoration of the martyrdom of General Soleimani shows that the Iranian people are appreciative of the services and efforts by this great martyr. Ayatollah Khamenei said Soleimani's school of thought was marked by sincerity and devotion. He said that the martyrdom of Soleimani has made the regional resistance movement more hopeful. The leader made these comments in a meeting with Soleimani's family, as well as members of a commission set up to honor him. The leader of Iran's revolution has said that resistance movements in the region are more hopeful today due to the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani. Now, Tehran is hosting a ceremony that is marking the first anniversary of the passing of a top Iranian religious figure, Ayatollah Mohammad Taghi Mesbah Yazdi. The ceremony wrapped up just hours ago. American philosopher Professor Mohammad Elukhsan was in attendance. He described Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi as a true philosopher with deep insights and great wisdom. He also said the late Ayatollah showed great interest in philosophical discussions and was open to differences of opinion on various topics. Ayatollah Mesbah Yazdi served in various positions during his lifetime and was involved in numerous research, cultural, educational, and political activities. He was a member of Iran's Assembly of Experts and passed away at the age of 85. Moving on, Iran says making scientific advancements, especially in the field of aerospace, is its inalienable right. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh, says meddlesome statements will not affect Iran's will for progress in aerospace. Khatibzadeh was referring to comments by American, French, and German officials on Iran's recent space launch. He rejected their claims that the move violated United Nations Security Council resolutions. The spokesman said Tehran reserves the right to expand its scientific know-how and will not wait for the approval of other countries. Also on Thursday, Iran said that it launched a domestically made satellite carrier with research payloads into space. Political commentator Masoud Shajari says the U.S. seeks to keep countries like Iran away from developing new technologies.
You really need to see what the U.S. policy as a colonial power is. It actually wants to keep everyone within the Middle East and beyond away from technology, keep them back in the Stone Ages, and as long as they're concerned, they don't want any development, any knowledge, any improvement of science, technology, or anything else within places like Iran. So, they're going to, every time there is an achievement, and indeed, this is a great achievement for Iranian satellite project, they are going to start moaning. They're going to start sort of associating it with the nuclear technology, etc., etc. This is expected, and the reality is that even by that definition, they should be sort of opposing to Iran to have universities or even schools. Because out of that, it could come technology, and it will come technology. Iran has been forefront of technology in a very vast area, despite all the sanction. And this is great achievement without the sanction. But with the sanction, this is actually almost a miracle.
And at least one Yemeni has been killed in the Saudi-led coalition's latest attack on the country's northern Sada province. Local media say the Saudi artillery attack has also injured three others in the Arakuj region. Saudi Arabia has stepped up its attacks on Yemen in recent weeks, targeting several cities across the country. Last month, the attacks left several civilians dead. Yemen has been devastated by the Saudi-led war from more than 6 years now. The war has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead and displaced millions more. It has also destroyed Yemen's infrastructure and spread famine. UN says the war has caused the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen. And at least three members of a Saudi death squad that murdered journalist Jamal Khashoggi on October 2019 are not spending their time in jail, but in luxury villas in Riyadh. That has been revealed by a leading British daily, The Guardian, citing a Saudi intelligence source. The three assailants are said to be living in seven-star accommodation inside government-run security compound. Two witnesses visiting the facility several times in the past 2 years have told the source that they have seen three men. And the same source says that the men include Salah al-Tukai. He is the forensic scientist who dismembered Khashoggi inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Al-Tawbay and the two other men have already been convicted on Khashoggi's killing before a Saudi court. The trial, however, was widely criticized as a sham, and now the latest report casts doubt further about on the Saudi claims that justice has been served. U.S. intelligence agencies have said Khashoggi was murdered by the order of the Saudi Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salah. And a writer and a political analyst, John White, believes that the latest revelations regarding Khashoggi's murder should not come as a surprise to anybody.
This is absolutely no surprise. This was murder most foul against the Saudi dissident journalist. He was also a US resident, which you would think would have afforded him some protection. And the cover-up that followed was with the compliance of Western governments. You offered only the most tepid criticisms and sanctions against bin Salman for the murder of Mr. Khashoggi. And so what we have is an indictment of Western foreign policy in terms of the relationship with the Saudis, which is less, Saudi Arabia is less a state and more a family business, whose business is murder. So these revelations come as absolutely no surprise. The men who were involved in this murder are very close to bin Salman, part of his inner coterie of thugs and cutthroats, and indeed they've been rewarded for services to Mr. bin Salman. The man's a cutthroat, it cannot be stressed enough. And this is less a country underpinned by laws, and more a family business underpinned by the rule of the knife.
Moving on, new customs rules take effect on Saturday for goods entering the UK from the European Union, but concerns have already been raised over possible food shortages caused by the new rules that are part of post-Brexit trade regulations. The new rules require UK importers to make a full customs declaration on goods arriving in their country. They're no longer allowed to delay the process for up to 175 days. The importers should also complete the correct paperwork at least 4 hours before the arrival of the goods. Animal and plant-based products need statements of origin certificates too. Now, a leading British food industry body says it is worried that the new border controls could lead to food shortages, and that is because, it says, not everyone in the supply chain might be ready for these controls. The company expects January to be a fraught month for its members. Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair is set to receive a knighthood from Queen Elizabeth, but many Britons believe that the Premier should be in prison for his role in the Iraq War instead of getting the title. Anti-war activists are accusing Blair of war crimes during the US-led invasion of Iraq back in 2003. Outraged by the royal court's decision, they are demanding Blair's trial at an international tribune. Georgia Ailet, and an environmentalist, says that it is a joke to put a war criminal on the New Year's honors list. Former lawmaker George Galloway calls Blair a mass murderer, liar, and charlatan who is now taking, quote, the biscuit. And GB News presenter Tonya Buxton says that she is sickened to see the knighthood of a man who caused the deaths of so many people. And the COVID pandemic is plummeting Europe hard, with new Omicron variant being blamed for the rapid surge. France has reported its all-time record of over 32,000 daily infections. This is the third straight day that the country logs over 2,000 cases, 200,000, that is, cases. Ramin Mazahari has more from Paris.
France has broken the European record for corona infections, and nations across Western Europe are also reaching new daily highs as the pandemic has entered a new but seemingly less deadly phase.
The coronavirus right now is exploding right now in France. It's very scary to see. I saw over 200,000 infections in France in one day. So I'm nervous. I'm trying to get back to the United States right now, and I'm waiting for a COVID test right now. I'm very nervous. I want to make sure that it's negative so I'm able to get back home.
France currently has over 4 million active cases of corona, but 99.9% of them are classified as mild. Daily deaths are half of what they were a year ago, while shorter quarantines are being approved. Cases are soaring in part because many more people are getting tested prior to holiday gatherings, but France's hospital admissions are just a third of previous peaks. It appears increasingly certain that the new Omicron variant may spread like wildfire, but that it is significantly less lethal, causing many to have a cautious sense of relief.
Corona is mainly just a bad flu. It's only a serious risk for certain types of people. But for the overwhelming majority of people, if you get vaccinated, if you quarantine when you have symptoms, if you use common sense to protect yourself and others, then all will be fine.
The high transmission rate of Omicron does have some taking scientifically questionable steps not seen since the early days of the pandemic. Paris has just made face masks mandatory in all public places, even outdoors. Some nations, which aren't seeing an increase in cases, have banned public holiday festivities anyway. France, Italy, and other countries are debating making their health passes even more restrictive, which many say is an abuse of personal freedom.
France has long been considered the most vaccine-skeptical nation in the world, but measures which amount to either get vaccinated or live in social isolation have coerced 80% of the country into getting vaccinated.
One fact appears vital. In France, the unvaccinated are far more likely to be in intensive care than those who have chosen to be inoculated. What many are hoping for in 2022 is that Omicron truly does herald the end of the lethal phase of Corona 19, which would render moot the controversies and uncertainties over how to best handle the long-running pandemic. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
And the world welcomes the new year with scaled-back celebrations due to restrictions aimed at battling the rising COVID infections led by Omicron. Americans gathered in New York's Times Square to watch the famous ball drop event, but it was scaled down to only 15,000 spectators. Brazil celebrated 2022 with fireworks while official events were canceled. The situation was the same for most of Europe, including Greece and Spain, but France even canceled its fireworks in Paris amid Omicron concerns. Those same concerns made Russia close down Moscow's iconic Red Square to the public and limit the celebrations of fireworks. 2022 marks the second straight year that COVID overshadows the New Year celebrations. Meanwhile, Australia begins 2022 with a record number of new COVID infections as an outbreak centered in the eastern states continues to grow. The country set a national record of over 33,000 daily new cases on Saturday in New South Wales. The state logged nearly 22,600 infections, which was a record. Victoria State set a record, too, with almost 7,500 new daily infections. Both eastern states have seen their COVID cases and related hospitalizations grow over the week since Christmas Day. That followed the easing of restrictions and happened despite higher vaccination levels in Australia. Meanwhile, a stampede at a famous Hindu shrine in Indian-controlled Kashmir has left dozens of people dead and 20 others injured. The incident happened in the early hours of Saturday as people gathered for New Year prayers. A senior police official says an argument had broken out, making people pushing each other. Authorities say the situation is under control now. Top leaders from Indian opposition and ruling parties, including Prime Minister Narendra Modi, have extended their condolences, and the Veer families. Modi has also announced $16,000 ex gratia to the next of kin of those who lost their lives. Now that brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you.
Aperture.
A quarter century after the fall of the Iron Curtain, never have there been so many politically driven walls in our world. Dividing communities, separating the rich from the poor, and marking borders, walls have become the preferred solution for resolving major conflicts. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. This week's documentary explores how the business of constructing barriers is pursued with ever greater physical, financial, and ideological vigor in the 21st century. From the Middle East to the wealthiest societies of the West, municipal, regional, and international walls have become the preferred means of resolving conflicts and addressing or avoiding civil unrest. Stay with us as we investigate the geopolitics of urban and cultural segregation as seen in Iraq, Brazil, and France.
Just imagine that tomorrow we were to live in private villages behind high security fences. The Mireille neighborhood in Toulouse. 35,000 people live here. From the outside, it's considered a volatile ghetto. The Mireille is dogged by high unemployment and boredom. At night, as a distraction, youngsters noisily rev their engines. This is a public area. Only one association is trying to maintain some sort of law and order, a local group called the Mediators.
Don't hang about right under the buildings. Go home. Look at the time. People are asleep now.
Okay, we'll go. Actually, until the Mediators tell us to go home, we hang around outside. Do the residents ever call the police to say they can't stand the bloody noise anymore? Yeah, it can happen. It happens often. They call the police, yeah, sure. We know that because they see that the police won't intervene, so they ask us to help. We get involved, but they're on public property, and we can talk to them. Tell them to put their motorbikes away. If they listen, all the better. The police never come here for that sort of thing. Well, if they do, it would be a game of cat and mouse, you know what I mean? In this kind of social housing, they now take care of their own security. They've learned to live without the police. That doesn't bother you? No, it's okay. I've never been scared. She's been here since 1975. I mean, sometimes I go out. I come back at 4 or 5 in the morning. Used to come home and I never had any problems. That means there's a... What about the police? Do they ever come here when you call them? The police? I don't know. I really don't know. But I think it would be worse if they did come. Zubir Sadi was born here, grew up here, and has witnessed the neighborhood slowly change. They've only just got their license as well. I've looked after him for a while now. All he did was stupid things. I saw the mix of people who used to live here. There were whites, Europeans, all sorts of backgrounds. I used to see my parents, they'd go and visit the neighbours. All sorts of different mixes of people, but slowly people began to leave. And we were lucky, because we experienced that kind of diversity. These youngsters don't know that. I was scared, to be honest. There was always so much noise. I saw cars set on fire. But unfortunately, the police would never come because they'd get attacked. So you felt the estate was left to fend for itself. Yeah, that's right. We'll turn over here. Paulette is one of the middle-class residents that has fled the social housing estates. There, that's it. That last building down there. I used to live there, up on the 6th floor. Do you ever come back?
No.
No. I never wanted to come back. And I never have. Why not? I don't feel comfortable. You see, where I live now, there are just 2 floors. Here, there can be as many as 15 floors. It's like cages for hens. Paulette moved to a nearby protected estate. There are more of them in Toulouse than anywhere else in France. She now feels much better. We all know each other. We're safe. We can leave the door open. No one can come in. There are no problems. We're not scared of anything. Here we go, this way. Enclosed residences are not necessarily ghettos for the rich. Paulette is a civil servant. That's nice, isn't it? She has a modest salary and a 45 square meter apartment like all those who live here. With her neighbours, Paulette has rediscovered some of the warmth of the poorer areas. I've got just about everybody's spare set of keys, because some of my neighbours are a bit scatty, so you never know. It's very friendly here in this residence. I think it's very pleasant to be here. We're not far from town, and it's a bit like being in the countryside. It's quiet, you can walk around. And there's a pool. It's like a holiday camp. But here, the rules are strict. Even too strict, says Christine, a resident. They've been sending out non-stop things, you know, like notices telling people how to behave, not to make too much noise. I think it's, well, yeah, the rules are a bit strict sometimes. I mean, to ask children not to shout outside when they need to shout. Kids shout. If I hear a kid laughing, I don't think it's a nuisance. That's all. You know, I'm fairly moderate. I don't know. I think it's a bit much. Well, it's not the kids for me, it's the adults. The ones who don't show respect for others, to be honest. There was one person here who wasn't very nice. He made a lot of mistakes. Well, he made noise once or twice. No, he was noisy. I mean, I couldn't sleep once. But my neighbour's camera picked him up. In this small paradise, if you make too much noise, the various security devices will hear you. We're undergoing an urban segregation in this country. Some have recently suggested using the term fragmentation to describe this new kind of town, made up of separate parts that have increasingly less in common with each other. So it really marks the end of a kind of society. Yes, it could well be the end of a certain type of society, or in fact a new multi-speed society, a club society, in which the public good is considered like a club. If you can afford it, you pay for membership of the club and benefit from the goods. If you can't, you won't have them. Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where the economy is booming. The country, though, is cut into two. The middle classes have flocked into enclosed areas, condominiums, entire sectors behind high railings and armed guards. Brazil is copying Florida with its gated communities, enclosed villages. Right next to the condominiums are the world's largest slums. Two nations, that of the rich and the poor, who live on either side of the ramparts. Thais and her mother always lived in the so-called condominios. Well, the idea for condominios came from keeping people closed off, but with hobbies and things to do on the inside. There's a bar where you can meet your friends. It's also to be close to each other without needing to go out or risk being attacked. Why? Because the streets are considered dangerous? Yes, yeah, especially at night. And you can't be at the mercy of other people in the streets. Unfortunately, that's today's reality. So they found the way to mix safety with hobbies and pastimes. It's like being outside. In fact, a whole generation is growing up inside the condominiums that will never get to know the real Brazil. It's true. I really think we've created gilded cages like this one. We're prisoners of luxury. I really wish my children were as lucky as I was. I grew up in an apartment block, but we used to play out in the streets. I had that freedom. Today, if I go past the same area where I grew up, I see it's no longer possible. Everyone's a bit more enclosed nowadays. Right alongside the condominiums are the favelas. It's the Brazil of the workers and cleaning women, as well as armed teenagers who live off the drugs trade. They form an alternative kind of justice in these forgotten slums. Shaolin has been in charge of the Residents Association for a long time. To him, segregation is the worst form of violence. More than the physical wall that separates us, there's the invisible social wall, which is far more hurtful. The superior classes in their buildings, and we, people of no class, in our huts. Right next to each other. The city has to integrate, otherwise there'll be chaos. Directly opposite the huge favela Rocinha on the São Conrado beach are some of the most expensive housing estates in Brazil. They're not just criminals up there. There are some better people up there than they are down here. More honest people. One day, Augusta witnessed a shootout between cocaine traffickers and military police. A scene from a war film. There was a problem fairly recently between the guys from the Vidigal favela and those from Rocinha. They encountered the military police and there was a fight. They ran off, and in the confusion, they crossed in, went out the other side. That's it. They caused no trouble. They just crossed through. You know, the wall, it's not real security. There are 500,000, 400,000 of them, and just 10,000 of us. If they come down, nothing will stop them. On the other side of the railings, the government decided to seize control of the favelas. November 2010, the army and its armored cars are called in. 4 days of fighting in the north zone eventually forces the traffickers out. Government troops hoist the national colors, a symbol of the victory of one nation over another. Today, Captain Felipe Barreto and his men are on patrol to prevent the gangs from returning. I don't know any city like Rio, with the rich right next to the poor, literally wall to wall. The social impact is very negative. You see down there, where the car is? Before, the police wouldn't have been able to go there. 20 meters away, they'd shoot at you. Just one cop on the corner and they'd open fire. So that was the border? Yeah, that was the border. And what about the other public services? Can they come in? Firemen, postmen, doctors? Well, before, it was only with the permission of the traffickers. So it was a parallel government. Exactly, the media used to call it parallel powers. Are there less now? Oh yeah, many were killed. And they fled as well, right? Yeah, all were arrested. Others moved to Rocinha. Rocinha is home to countless thousands of poor. Among them, some heavily armed young men. The traffickers tolerated our presence on their territory so long as we never filmed them. And we were given escorts. One longtime member of the drug world does, however, agree to be interviewed. Nowadays, Regis has stopped dealing. He's settled down, has a family and work, and tries to lead a dignified life. Like most dealers, Regis was also an addict. I took a lot of drugs for 10 years. From the ages of 15 to 26, I hit rock bottom. A lot of cocaine, alcohol. Oh, it lasted for 10 years. I lost my friends, traffickers, thieves. I used to live among all of that. They call me the last of the Mohicans. Why? Because the rest of my generation are all dead. For many of the favela's youngsters, drugs remains the easiest career move. With the intoxicating feeling the street belongs to you. They are arrogant and well-armed, but few will live to see 30. They will be killed by the police or rival gangs. People used to look at me differently. They'd look away when they saw me. My own mother didn't trust me anymore. But thanks to God, I was able to get out of it. Now I have my daughter, my wife, my house and my work. It must be a struggle. Yeah, it is a struggle. But the most important thing is to have abandoned the drug scene. The favelas issue is about successive governments having basically abandoned them. It's just government negligence. That's why we're in the state we're in today. After having assaulted the area, the police tries to do some social work. A community police unit has set up in the middle of the favela. It's aimed to stop the drug gangs returning. We arrive, we set up, and then we determine what the needs are, and we try and get back into the areas that have been abandoned by the state. Yeah, by the state and by society in general. Captain Barreto's men have established an advance base at the top of the favela. It's a strategic position with a bird's eye view over the condominiums. And Baghdad, the city of 1,000 walls. After 8 years of war, a fragile peace exists behind these concrete ramparts. The walls crisscross the city over hundreds of kilometers, causing never-ending detours. Abu Hazem is a taxi driver in the Daura district, which was controlled by insurgents back in 2007. I have to go around the wall, go to the end of the motorway, and come all the way back. It's like a huge prison. It's bad for morale, too. Does the wall make it safer? Does it bring work? Well, in fact, the wall has made it safer. Before, no one could pass here. It was too dangerous. Between 2003 and 2007, Iraq was ravaged by an incredibly vicious civil war. U.S. soldiers were constantly targeted. Certain areas were completely controlled by the insurgents. Then the Shiite and Sunni militias began killing each other. According to The Lancet, a respected medical journal, 600,000 civilians were killed. That's when the Americans conceived of the idea of building walls around the most violent areas. They would contain the insurrection and separate the Sunnis from the Shiites. Baghdad would resemble Berlin during the time of the wall. The U.S. Army spokesman, however, confirms they are also building gated housing, like the retired people's homes in California.
We're building different walls all throughout the city here, different communities, and you've heard the concept of gated communities.
Mm-hmm. Funny, a gated community, to me, just connotes, you know, an exclusive sort of Coral Gables, Florida kind of setup, which is not what you mean, is it?
The gated communities are designed to protect the population in selected neighborhoods throughout Baghdad.
Many of them don't like it at all. They feel that it will further divide the city on sectarian lines.
Well, the intent is not to divide the city on sectarian lines. Once again, the intent is to provide a more secure neighborhood for the people that live in selected neighborhoods. And if we find areas that we think that the gated communities will do good and will control the population, we'll probably build more.
Each zone is surrounded by a wall. It's like living on a reserve. We're stuck inside. The wall was the Americans' idea. It was American material and vehicles that were used to build it. There never was the split between Sunnis and Shiites before the Americans arrived. Sunnis, Shiites, Christians and Jews, we were all Iraqis first. And the first thing the Americans ask you now is, are you Shiite or Sunni?
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
Sheikh Javed Akbari, the researcher on Islamic studies from Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. We shall talk about the subject of infaq or spending in the way of Allah for the sake of Allah, to attain proximity to Allah, to attain nearness to Allah, ultimately to help one's own human fellows, brothers and sisters who are in need. And that is the goal of infaq. According to different verses of the Holy Quran, infaq should be for the pleasure of Allah. Of course, you can just go to verse 177 of chapter Al-Baqarah. You can find verses. There are as many as 60 verses in the Holy Quran which point to the concept of infaq. Infaq has to fulfill certain conditions and certain requirements in order for the results that we should achieve and gain. So infaq or charity or spending in the way of Allah should fulfill certain conditions, and it should be for the welfare of the poor and without any expectations of reward. These are something which the Quran refers to, and there are verses that you can find that you should not give charity with the intention that you want to oblige other people. You see, lot, you should not give your sadaqah or charity or infaq or whatever you give to help other people with the intention that you want to oblige other people, or you want to tell him one day sooner or later that, okay, you are the one who helped him and he was in misery and you helped him. This should not be there, okay? Also, infaq should not be given for the purpose of pretense or showing off. You know, there are people who spend in public places and their intention is to simply kind of showing themselves to other people, okay, that they are people who give charity. It's useless. If you want to attain proximity to Allah, of course, you shouldn't do it for the sake of showing off. And that's why it's always recommended that you give your charity secretly. And infaq should be given secretly. It's better to give it secretly. And in that case, of course, you will earn the reward. And obviously, you will not attain true piety unless you give out of what you cherish. لَن تَنَالُوا الْبِرَّ حَتَّى تُنْفِقُوا مِمَّا تُحِبُّونَ. So you need to give something that you like to give, okay, that you like to have, but you want to give a portion of it or a part of it to the needy, to the poor people. Infaq is an important Quranic instruction which is given to all mankind, and particularly Muslims are the people addressed by these verses of the Quran. And this instruction means that you have to spend all your income and wealth beyond the requirements. Okay, you need something for your day-to-day expenses and for your day-to-day expenditures, and that's what you need. You have to keep it for yourself. But if you have wealth in excess of your needs, if you have money in excess of your needs and requirements, of course, you have to give a portion of it to the needy people. Quran actually has given extraordinary emphasis on the concept of charity and on spending out and giving something to the needy and to the poor people. That's what infaq is. Let's have a break and I'll be back to you in a few seconds. Infaq is one of the most important tools to run the economy of the Muslim society. The Muslim society cannot run without proper management, without proper economy. Islam is not opposed to wealth. We need money, we need economy, we need resources. But it should not be in the hand of one particular person or one particular organization. So everybody is supposed to work hard, everybody is supposed to have something to live with. But if he has something in excess of what he needs, then it is highly recommended that he give a part of it to the needy. So by doing infaq, actually a man does not lose his income and wealth, because Allah has given guarantees that he will be rewarded manifold. Quran says the parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 ears, sab'a sanabil, with 100 grains in every ear, and Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving and knowing. What a wonderful ayah of the Quran. If you give $1 as charity, it will multiply manifold until it becomes 100. You know, Wallahu yudha'ifu liman yasha, and of course God multiplies for whom He pleases. All of these benefits are subject to some conditions, of course. You know, these conditions must be fulfilled. For example, it should be only to get the pleasure of God. It should be only qurbatan ila Allah. You know, we should do everything to achieve closeness to Allah and proximity to Allah. And if there is such an intention behind whatever we do, then that result, that multiplication will take place. The infaq or spending should be for goodness and without any expectation of reward, without any obligation, without ending up and telling the recipient of the infaq, okay, I did help you, I did this and that, okay. There should not be any kind of obligation. And of course, the infaq should not be for showing off, you know, for publicity. If there is such thing, such an intention, then obviously it will wipe out all the benefits that we may achieve at the end of the day. Welcome to your program for a better life. One of the verses and one of the examples I give you, the example of the parable مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة. This is one important example, and there are many examples in the Quran. For example, zakat is one of the examples. Sadaqa, zakatul fitr, and these are obligatory infaq. Okay, these are obligatory manifestations of infaq. But there are also voluntary, mustahab infaq. These are numerous, you know. There is a saying in the Quran, or there is a verse in the Quran which says, you will not attain true goodness until you give what you love. لَن تَنَالُ الْبِرَّ حَتَّى تُنْفِقُوا. You will not achieve goodness, you will not achieve righteousness, and you will not achieve piety until you give what you love. Okay? So infaq encircles all obligatory as well as voluntary ways of spending in the way of Allah. Infaq, generally speaking, is a kind of or is a type of charity in Islam that is given without any expectation, without any obligation, and there should be certain requirements, and these requirements should be fulfilled. And whatever we spend in the way of God, it should be for God's sake. At the end of the day, we will benefit from the charity, from the infaq that we do. The Quran says you should not destroy your sadaqah or your infaq by giving obligation to other people. And also the Quran says whatever you infaq you do, it is for yourself. وَمَا تُنْفِقُونَ إِلَّا ابْتِغَاءَ وَجْهِ اللَّهِ. And you should not infaq except for seeking the pleasure of Allah. God knows everything that we do. God is well aware of whatever we do, and whatever you spend in good, it will be repaid to you. You know, وَمَا تُنْفِقُوا مِنْ خَيْرٍ يُوَفَّ إِلَيْكُمْ. It will be repaid to you in full, and you should not be wronged. So, dear brothers and sisters, there are many verses to be explained, and there are many, you know, concepts related to the concept of infaq which can be explained. Of course, the religious authorities, the exegetes of the Holy Quran, and the Muslim scholars have elaborated on this concept in detail. Thank you very much. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, He knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, He knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, He knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, He knows. Allah knows.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.